You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. This week, we have a special Local Motion for you. We're bringing you a regional roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Maeve Conran. KVNF is a member of Rocky Mountain Community Radio. It's a fantastic network of community radio stations like KVNF all over the Mountain West that come together to share stories and resources. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Maeve Conran, the coalition's managing editor, and coming up on today's show, we'll hear about food insecurity in the Rocky Mountain West.
The impotence you feel as a single parent with a sick child and another one that's special needs.
The impact of immigration detention on families.
I was crying, I was shaking, my hands were sweating up.
A Utah author shares her life as a rancher in her new memoir, A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey.
I was the only woman cattle ranch owner for a long time in this county and in the state.
And how public radio stations are faring in the wake of the loss of all federal funding.
The loss of that is horrific for local, hyper-local communities.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. Tens of thousands of people in the region rely on the federal food assistance program known as SNAP. Those benefits were cut off in the final 12 days of the government shutdown that ended on November 12th. Aspen Public Radio's Sarah Torrey reports on the turmoil that one family endured with the loss of their food stamps.
Yay, I got an extra stick of butter.
Anna Harris is showing me the box where she keeps food for herself and her two boys. She's in the communal kitchen at the Ronald McDonald House in Denver. It's a place for families to stay at no cost while their kids get hospital treatment. Her son, Eric, has leukemia. There isn't much left in Anna's box.
I have some stuff, but not really anything to make a meal.
An almost empty bag of shredded cheese, a few tortillas.
And I got a bunch of carrots and pickled onions.
I first met Anna back in August at the mobile food pantry in Silt, run by Lift Up. She's a single mom to five, a domestic violence survivor, and she has a knack for resourcefulness, like learning how to fix her car.
I can change an alternator. I can change the starter.
Anna's sole income comes through Medicaid. She gets paid as a caretaker for her youngest child. Arthur is 12 and has severe disabilities. To feed herself and her three boys at home, she relies on food stamps. $1,200 a month, and she uses her local Lift Up pantry. But a few weeks ago, everything changed. Eric, her 16-year-old, hadn't been feeling well. He was sleeping all the time, losing weight. She took him to the doctor, and then to the hospital in Grand Junction for tests. Anna got the call with Eric's diagnosis in the middle of the night.
In the morning, I woke up and I asked my oldest, I was like, did I have a nightmare or was this call real?
He needed immediate treatment for his leukemia. So Anna drove Arthur and Eric to Denver.
When I first got here, I had $100 left in food stamps. So I made sure and I got the pork chops and I got him soup.
Meanwhile, the money in Anna's food stamp account dwindled.
Yeah, I'm craving a lot of pretzels for some reason, but I gotta focus on protein. But yeah, I've been also craving a lot of tangerines.
It's November 6th, 5 days since SNAP payments ended, and Anna has $1 left in food stamps.
The impotence you feel as a single parent with a sick child and another one that's special needs and two more at home is just, I honestly sometimes end up in tears in the parking lot.
Though Denver has food pantries, Anna can't get to them easily. Ronald McDonald House rules prevent her from leaving Eric in the building alone, and he's too sick to go with her. The chemo makes him tired, and his immune system is weak.
I'm scared that one cold can bring him down.
Eric will need ongoing treatment in Denver for the next 2 years. And without SNAP payments, Anna's financial situation has grown more precarious.
I haven't paid my bills. I haven't paid my mortgage, my car payment, anything. See, this is usually full, but it's not.
This isn't the first time Anna has found herself in similar circumstances. When she gave birth to Eric and his twin sister prematurely, Anna stayed in the same Ronald McDonald House while they were in the NICU. Back then, she didn't have food stamps or any money.
I was by myself, pumping my milk. I didn't have any food. I would buy one can of corn and go to the cafeteria, get Parmesan cheese and a thing of mayonnaise, and I would make Mexican street corn.
In the years since, Anna worked hard to make sure she'd never be in that situation again. She bought a dehydrator and dehydrated fruits and vegetables. She created an emergency supply of canned food, and she started an herb garden inside her house.
I have fresh basil and rosemary and mint.
For a while, Anna felt like she had finally found a little bit of stability. With SNAP benefits and access to food banks like Lift Up, she was getting by, barely. And then,
just when I get settled, something else happens.
To Anna, a lot of her life has felt that way. Before I leave, she looks into the communal freezer.
I have a few things. I got chicken wings, Texas toast, and broccoli.
Anna isn't sure how much longer her remaining food will last, but she knows she will do anything to make sure her kids are fed.
I've lost everything so many times, but I bounce back.
For Aspen Public Radio, I'm Sarah Torrey.
Immigrant detention is rising across the Mountain West, and communities are feeling the impact. In Teton County, Wyoming, about 100 people have been transferred from the county jail to Immigration and Customs Enforcement since March, a pace that the sheriff describes as steady. Among them is a Jackson woman's husband, a home builder who's lived in the US for nearly 30 years. He was detained in July while out of town, despite having legal work authorization, no criminal record, and an active path towards citizenship. She spoke with KHOL's Jenna McMurtry and Emily Cohn on the condition of anonymity. We begin with her describing the moment that she learned her husband wouldn't be coming home.
I was crying, I was shaking, my hands were sweating up because I never drove over there in the big city, and it's like, I don't know what to do. I was like frozen, like. We never been apart before, never ever. Even though he went back for his visas, he have like 5 visas and he was going back and forth from Mexico to here, but was only a couple weeks and he come back. But this is the longest time that we've been separated. I wish somebody can, like, I have someone to tell me what to do in that moment. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have, like, even though as a family, we talk about this when Trump started with the new administration. We talk, me and my family, like my kids and my husband and I, we need to have a plan B, and a plan C if anything happens. But we didn't talk it deeply until we have this situation. And I wish I had someone at that moment that I can talk to, or they can help me to say, okay, this is the next step, because I don't know anything. I don't know what to do. I was like frozen, like, what is the next step? What do we need to do? Like, the only thing that we knew, is that Karina told us, I recommend you to get a lawyer. That's it. From then I was like, okay, and what I'm gonna go and talk to the lawyer? What did I have to say to the lawyer? What did I need to say to the, I don't know anything about, nothing, zero. So he was calling us every day. You had to pay for everything there. Yep, and you had to pay for everything. So for FaceTiming was like almost $7. For phone calls it was like, 35 cents or, 35 cents, 40 cents for call. We had to make an account so he can able to call us, so that way we can put money onto his account. Now I can tell somebody, well, this is the next step. If somebody come and grab your husband, or he goes and have an interview with immigration, this is what you need to do. This is the steps that you need to take. I don't know what's gonna happen, because right now he's gonna have another court, I think a couple more. And we don't know if they're gonna give back his permit and his driver's license. We don't know anything right now. And this country has given us a lot. And we're very thankful of this country, and we never say anything bad. Like, I know we going through tough stuff right now because of the president or whatever. But we always very thankful, and we always said we want to keep living our lives here in U.S. Because right now we don't go back to Mexico. We don't want to go back to Mexico. I mean, our whole life is here, me and my husband. My husband got here when he was 17. I got here when I was 15. So our whole life is here. We're very grateful for this country, because it's given us a lot.
Though the family is together now, they're still waiting on a hearing, and the threat of separation looms. That report was from KHOL's Jenna McMurtry and Emily Cohen. You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. I'm Maeve Conran. Heidi Redd has been running cattle at Dugout Ranch in Utah for over 60 years. Dugout Ranch is adjacent to the Needles District of Canyonlands National Park. It encompasses more than 5,000 acres of pasture land, as well as water rights and permits to graze cattle on more than 350,000 acres of adjacent federal land. It's the largest private inholding in Bears Ears National Monument. KSUT's Tammy Graham spoke with Heidi Redd about her new memoir, A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch.
Heidi, in 2010, the Dugout Ranch, as you know well, launched the Canyonlands Research Center in partnership with the Nature Conservancy, and that included several other federal agencies, USGS, USDA, Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, Utah State University, and the Division of Wildlife Resources. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit with our listeners about why this work is so important, and a little bit about the work that is being done at Dugout Ranch in this vein.
Well, with changing climates, the research center has been a leading research center in the West, along with other. We also collaborate with other research centers, and we have been studying things, and it's interesting that we've been doing it for more than 10 years, which is important because we need that history of how things are changing in our native grasses, and frankly in the amount of water that we have in our creeks now. And one of our big studies that my son has been conducting is on the Criollo cattle, which were cattle that Christopher Columbus brought over with him. And they have been in Copper Canyon for all these years. So genetically, they're still the same breed as when they arrived. And why we've been interested in them is because they're a smaller animal. They will go further from water grazing and need a little bit less water. They also, one of the big things is they will not only eat grass, but also browse, and almost like a deer. And so the grasses, it can be more of an equal thing instead of just hitting the grasses. So we've had this study, like I say, going on for 10 years. We're kind of wrapping it up. And we've had radio collars on them so we can track to see exactly how far do they travel away from water. Is it, working here as it has in other places? Also, we need to know exactly what they're eating to know if that part of the scenario is right. And sure enough, well, we three times a year have their feces checked. So this has been an ongoing study, and we found it's interesting because they are smaller and they're very lean. There's hardly any marbling, which we Americans tend to like that. So we have found that with crossbreeding them, we're trying to see if we can get with the crossbreed the best of both sides. And that's still an ongoing study.
Why is this so important? And I understand why it's important ecologically. Why is it important to you personally?
Well, because our lands are our living. And if we can find an easier way, not an easier way, but a lighter way to be on the land with cattle and produce a calf that buyers want, that will be just a lot lighter on the land, and they won't be hitting just the grasses. They can eat both. They can graze. And it's important that they graze further from water, because then they aren't concentrated around streams or springs or our water holes so much. They can get out further and graze further.
Heidi Redd's new book is a memoir reflecting on her more than six decades in ranching.
Well, I've been at the ranch for 60 years, and I've seen it change from, you know, you talked about the Needles District of Canyon Eyes National Park. Well, that was all part of the ranch when I was first here. And they made it a park a few years after. While we hated to lose another couple of hundred thousand acres, it was and has been a real asset to, I think, the world. It's a beautiful park, and it is being protected the way it should be. As far as running cattle here, my ex-husband and I ran the cattle together for 23 years. And then he wanted to move on, and I wanted to stay. And so we made that arrangement. But through those years here, running the ranch, you know, at first I was the only woman cattle ranch owner for a long time in this county and in this state. And so that was an interesting transition. But I must say that through all that time, the cowboys and the men I've worked with have been very good, not at all afraid to have a woman running things, which I've really appreciated. But the adventures through these years from, of course, when I first started, took over, I had a debt, and I had to figure out how I was going to pay off this debt with just more than cattle. And so I started doing some movies. I did a little bit of Riders of the Purple Sage and City Slickers too. But the real helpful was Marlboro. Mm-hmm. Marlboro came in, and they came three times a year. And that crew was just fabulous, and economically it really helped a lot. But you know, as a rancher, you're doing multiple things. You're not only out in the saddle all the time, and we lived in line camps most of the time, but you're a bookkeeper, you're a vet, you have to figure out the finances all the time and then keep everybody happy. And so it is juggling a lot of balls, which I really loved. And the part I love most about ranching is on the back of a horse. Mm. And that to me was my paycheck. Mm. And the nice thing with us, I feel that cowboys have it great, because we never have to wait for the weekend to enjoy life. We enjoy it every day.
Heidi Redd's new memoir is A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch. She was speaking with KSUT's Tammy Graham. October 1st marked a major shift for public broadcasting. For the first time in nearly six decades, public radio and television stations began operating without any federal support. In July, Republicans in Congress approved President Trump's proposal to eliminate all federal funding for public media. They even clawed back money that had been already allocated to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The move has forced the CPB to shut down permanently. To find out how this is impacting public and community radio stations across the country, I spoke with Rima Dial, the Chief Executive Officer of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters.
The reality in terms of finances is we're seeing some stations, actually not the super small stations, but the medium-sized stations, react that they might be closing their doors. So we actually do have some community radio stations and some community television stations that are opting out of carrying national programming. And some of that programming comes from NPR and from PBS. And now they're looking for partners to develop local content, or they're shifting their model of laying off workers and they're bringing in more community volunteers. So we're officially in limbo, is really the most honest answer. We expect, though, over the next year or two, for 50 to even possibly 100 stations across the public media system to close. And this was the forecasting that was done by CPB and the Government Accountability Office several years ago. So they knew coming into the recession, and this is why CPB, NPR, PBS, and the rest of community radio stations, especially folks at like RIMCOR, really were trying to fight hard because they projected what this horrific impact could be. And most importantly, the folks who are hurting in all this are our friends and neighbors on the local level. As we know, the reality of news and information systems, whether it's newspapers or other media outlets, are closing, and they're shifting their models. And so some of our community radio stations and public radio stations are it. That's it for both emergency alerting as well as news and information. And the loss of that is horrific for local, hyper-local communities.
I can't even imagine what this means in terms of the existing news deserts. It's obviously going to create new news deserts where there will be entire communities without any news coverage. Do you have a sense of where in the country is this spread evenly, the impact? Are you seeing certain areas at more risk?
The folks that are at more risk is the Midwest, Southwest, and Southeast. So it's the middle of the country. However, going back to the original data that was released, and this was pre-pandemic data on the news deserts, what wasn't included there was the community radio stations as well as multilingual and ethnic stations. And when I say stations, I mean media outlets, whether that be newspapers or radio stations or public television. Now, those folks, public radio, community media, are stepping up to do more for their local communities. But the capacity, as you know, of volunteer-driven stations is very different than professionally paid staff. Not saying that one is better than the other. They're just different models of how you provide news. So while community radio and community television can provide companionship and coverage of local PTA meetings, town halls, and such, there are regional issues that are still being lost. For example, trans issues is a perfect example of things that are being talked about at a state level and state system that needs to be then translated to how that impacts folks on a local level. Same thing of being in this COVID environment that we're in. Yes, COVID still exists, despite the fact that the CDC has changed their regulations on what they're saying about who can have access to COVID shots. That's regional and national reporting that doesn't necessarily filter down to hyper-local levels. And so there needs to be partnerships across both regional, national, and hyper-local reporting. And those are the potholes. That's what I've been calling them. They're potholes in our news and information civic infrastructure that are impacting the Midwest, Southwest, and Southeast very differently. And also, it's impacting regional communities and BIPOC communities in urban areas as well. So one can paint the picture of that this is a problem of an all over the country problem, but it's different specific communities and niche communities that are impacted. So it's not like all of Chicago or all of Miami or all of Denver. It's specific communities that are losing out on the information that they're getting to make decisions for their families.
The other issue I've heard many times is when you don't have very local reporting, all the issues are pegged to what's happening nationally and pegged to that temperature, which is often what we're seeing around division. And we see this play out in the book banning efforts, in local library districts, efforts to remove books and school board races. Can you talk a little bit about that, about really what that means for the bigger picture of politics and division in this country?
So I'm originally from the Philippines, and I spent my time in my formative years growing up all over Southeast Asia. So I've lived in countries where there were communist governments and authoritarian regimes. And the commonality of how I grew up in the 70s and 80s and our current political climate is ordinary people live for the mundane, right? We want to make sure birthdays, bar mitzvahs, Christmas, Easter, Diwali is all celebrated. And those are the commonalities that remove divisions. And so when local reporting and hyper-local storytelling disappears, it increases the division that is highlighted in our countries. Because as you said, everything gets pegged on the national issues. But what really brings us together as a community are the local sports scores, the pops and jazz concerts that are played at the high school, your kid in their middle school play or their dance recital or piano recital, or the local peewee sporting event for, you know, minor league baseball that happens. Those are all things that local reporting and local storytelling does. And when that disappears, all you see are then the breaks and the fractions that happen on a national level because we're all painted as an us versus them, when really we're not an us versus them. We're all about wanting to raise our friends and families in safe, secure ways, and we want security and food. And those are the basic things for a healthy, happy life.
People listening to this are listening on their local public, their local community radio station, and hopefully many of them have contributed, especially in the recent fall membership drives. But what else can communities be doing at this point?
Talk to your local leaders about the important role that your local favorite public radio station or community radio station has as part of the civic infrastructure for your local community. Because whether or not it's an emergency alert, or God forbid, it's an active shooter scenario, or flooding, or it tells you when your 4th of July fireworks are going to be, those are the roles that local media plays that regional and national media cannot do for our friends and neighbors of where we live. So please give now. Pretty please to your favorite local radio station, but then talk to your local officials that you listen to your local station.
Rima Dial with the National Federation for Community Broadcasters, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me.
Thank you very much, Maeve.
You've been listening to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to Aspen Public Radio's Sarah Torrey, KHOL's Jenna McMurtry and Emily Cohen, and KSUT's Tammy Graham for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for listening.
This has been Locomotion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks so much for listening this week. Locomotion airs every Tuesday at 6 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. If you ever miss a Locomotion on air that you want to hear, you can always find past episodes by looking under the news tab at kvnf.org. and looking for Locomotion. Thanks so much for listening.